Bringing you the latest research, tools, and common sense tips you need to get and stay healthy. It's Talk Healthy Today. Here's Lisa Davis.
Mental health is such a big issue, and we need to talk about it. I grew up understanding mental health issues, I think, more than some of the people in my life, because my grandmother had bipolar, and I knew that she was in and out of institutions, and I knew it was really hard on my mother, and I knew that Grammy had a mental health illness, just like some people have physical illnesses. And I think that really helped me to be more compassionate. And I think we really need to educate ourselves. And the best place to start is this incredibly great book, No One Cares About Crazy People. It is by Ron Powers, The Chaos and Heartbreak of Mental Health in America, who joins us now. Ron, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Lisa.
Ron, I was so moved by the book. I couldn't put it down. From the first sentence in the book where you talk about your son and his suicide and then your other son having schizophrenia as well. And it was so powerful. This is a book I promised myself I would never write.
Yes.
And I was so interested to know what happened and why and then what changed. And I don't like to give a lot of way, so I will let you share a bit about that. But I'm so glad you did write the book, because it is crushing and important. Go ahead.
Grateful for your thoughts, Lisa. Thank you so much. The circumstances were that my wife, Honoré, and I have had two wonderful boys. And when I say wonderful, these were beams of light. Kevin, who took his life in 2005, a week before his 21st birthday, was a guitar prodigy. He was an imp, a happy, modest, wonderful kid. And I emphasize this, Lisa, because part of the reason for writing the book was to dispel myths about people who have this awful disease. One of the myths is that they're just not very happy people. They're angry, depressed, alienated, and it turns into schizophrenia. This is just wrong. Both Kevin and Dean, who survives, developed a brain disease, not mental afflictions that could be cured through therapy. Schizophrenia is inherited through the genes, to the extent of our knowledge now. And it's a very rare clustering of genes that are passed along. I think scientists have isolated about 128. You may know more about this than I do. I'm really a layman. But the genes have to be present in a precise combination for schizophrenia to develop. And even then, many people go through life having the components, but they've been lucky enough not to have the external pressures that trigger these flawed genes and produce psychosis. And the leading trigger of this, as we now believe, is stress. Stress in the womb, stress in early childhood, and stress in mid-adolescence, when the brain is undergoing its final series of changes that will carry the person through adulthood. During these changes, the brain kind of empties out of cells that are used up, and it's going to replace them with new and vital and more sophisticated cell networks. But during that pruning, as it's called, the brain is very vulnerable. This is why many outbreaks occur in mid-adolescence. So to quickly finish off my thought, yes, Kevin ceased taking his medications against our wishes and took his life. Our older son, Dean, prevails at age 35, clinging to his regimen of medications and living in a loving household. Two very, very important components in bringing schizophrenic people back.
Well, I am so incredibly sorry for your loss. I mean, that was just absolutely heartbreaking. And, you know, one of the things you wrote that I thought was so profound, you said, "I hope you do not enjoy," with quotes, "this book, I hope you are wounded by it. Wounded, as I have been in writing it, wounded to act, to intervene. Only if this happens and keeps happening until it needs to happen no more, can we dare to hope that Dean and Kevin, with all their brothers and sisters in psychotic suffering, are redeemed, that they have not suffered entirely in vain. I did not enjoy the book, but I did enjoy the book. I mean, I think it's so important that we educate ourselves. As a matter of fact, I need to send you a book that I was I co-authored. It's an anthology called Easy to Love but Hard to Live With, and it's about people who have mental health issues or other brain-based disorders like autism spectrum, learning disabilities. It has people sharing their stories and then people who love them. My daughter has autism spectrum, ADHD, dyslexia. And when you wrote about that helplessness, because she's good and she's so creative and she's so sweet, and it reminded me of reading about your sons, and that feeling is so difficult.
Well, it is, and I would love to see this book, Lisa.
Yeah, I'll get it to you.
I hope you will mail it to me.
I will.
I think just a minute ago you used the word, I believe, helplessness.
Yes.
That is one of the most debilitating consequences of having a mentally ill person in the household or within the range of your affection. Parents are genetically wired to help, to solve, to find a way through a difficult situation for the child. Schizophrenic children, unless they are dealt with early intervention, good professional care, and a rational system of meds, absent these ingredients, they do deteriorate. And my wife, Anna Ray, and I have both had the experience, even though Kevin was being treated, of watching him get worse and not be able to do anything to prevent it. It's just an awful situation to be in.
It really is. You know, I remember when I was growing up and I would hear stories about my grandmother who had bipolar, and she didn't like taking the medicine because she was really vivacious and creative and full of energy, and it made her feel dull and bleh.
Yeah.
But it was so hard for my mother because she would be so unpredictable, and you can't force people. And one of the things I thought was so interesting is in the beginning of the book how you talk about the moment, your aha moment in terms of writing the book. Describe to us a little bit. And when you saw the people there with the mental illness, we were like, wait a second.
That was the moment in which I realized that the mentally ill had become invisible to me. Mm. And I said, shame on me. I who had suffered the loss of a beloved son over a period of several years, I had become sort of desensitized, as we all are,
yes,
to the presence. We instinctively recoil. There's a primal fear attached to our awareness of mental illness, and I've told people, and it's in the book, this, I think, is where our myths originate of the werewolf, the vampire, Dr. Jekyll morphing into Mr. Hyde. The idea that a person can seem to be normal one minute and turn into something completely incomprehensible the next is a terribly threatening thing, because we instinctively think that could happen to me too. And of course it can, but rarely. So we turn away and we leave these people to their own devices politically and in terms of the court system and the police system, as well as personally. We're in a situation right now where Congress, and I'm not trying to be partisanly political here,
but you're right.
Medicaid is in danger of evaporating, and with it something like $880 billion in benefits paid by the year 2026. What this will mean is a lot of mentally ill people who are functioning now, some may have jobs, others are at least aware they're performing artistic activities. If they can't afford to sustain their meds, we are going to return as a nation to the state of Bedlam Asylum 700 years ago in London, when the mentally ill were first rounded up and collected and thrown into dungeons and beaten and treated abysmally. This is a very fragile membrane we're all standing on, and it could revert to that kind of state of nature without very much momentum or, you know, impetus. I think you know what I'm talking about.
I
it's do. A very serious threat that's facing us.
It really is, and it reminds me of, you know, looking at Kennedy and in the book and in the, you know, the early 63. He
yes.
thought he was doing good by mentally ill people, but putting them out on the streets and then saying there'll be community centers, but then there wasn't any money. And didn't Reagan do the same thing? Wasn't there, like, a lot of cuts with the mental, if I remember correctly?
Well, yes. I mean, there's so many Hobson's choices that surround mental illness. Do you incarcerate, not incarcerate, institutionalize, put in a hospital, and give emergency meds to someone in psychosis? Intuitively, you say, well, of course, but there are thoughtful people who say this is a violation of their civil liberties. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but the fact is they're not capable of making rational choices, so they need help. But to get back to your example of the bill that President Kennedy signed in 1963, it was a measure with an awful name, deinstitutionalization. I said it sounds like a platter of silverware falling down a staircase, and it's as bad as it sounds.
It is.
Good intentions. Let's get the mentally ill out of these awful, decrepit, confining giant hospitals and into the community where they can be cared for on a more intimate and personal level. Well, the emptying out happened, starting in California and fanning west across, and east across the country. But then the Vietnam War happened, and it ate up the budget that had been set aside for creating these centers. As always, war trumps compassion. And so they had nowhere to go, at least half of them. And I'm talking about tens of thousands of impaired people. They formed the first street population of any size, the homeless. The homeless had no way to subsist other than, in some cases, petty crimes, thievery. Then they were arrested, and then they were thrown into prisons. And today, Lisa, our prison population has more mentally ill than conventional criminals in it, something like a little more than half. The cost of this staggers the imagination. It costs by a factor of five more to incarcerate a person than to give the same person treatment. So it's a great drag on our economy. We spend something like $444 billion a year in lost wages, lost productivity, the cost of care on the mentally ill, because we're just not going at it the right way.
Yeah, it's so true. And what do we need to do? Because it's so overwhelming when you're looking at what we have against us, looking at, and I will get political, looking at the current administration, looking at the attitudes. Where do we go? How do we not just get so downhearted and discouraged?
Well, I think we speak up.
Definitely.
I hope this is addressing your question.
Oh, yes.
But the stigma that creates silence and withdrawal is a great enemy of families of people with schizophrenia. And they are afraid. They stigma is a powerful, powerful demonic force. And we don't want to be looked at with fear and condescension. So we don't tell our story. Because of my book, I have entree into websites that are closed except to people who are afflicted and their relatives. And the stories that I read every day of silent suffering, of anguish over a son who is slipping away from control, and the contempt by the local caregivers, certainly the courts. I'm following a story right now on Facebook on a closed site of a woman whose gentle, delicate 16-year-old son is sharing a cell with a bully who regularly beats him bloody and gives him concussions. She can't get him out of there. So to answer your very good question, we need to speak up. We need to amplify. We need to educate our politicians. Chris Christie, a few weeks ago, governor of New Jersey, was quoted as saying he has no problem with solitary confinement. Mr. Christie, it's the worst thing you can do other than physical beating to a person.
Oh, it's horrendous.
We are social animals. To put someone in solitary deepens their psychosis. I'm blathering on, I realize.
No, you're not. You're so compelling, Ron, really.
And you're raising incredibly important questions.
Oh, I'm glad. You know, I want to go back to something about the connection between creativity and genius. I mean, your son was, Kevin was just an amazing guitar player. Yes. He was in the Berklee School of Music and he was 17. And talk about that genius creativity connection with mental illness. Obviously not across the board, but for some.
Yes, there have been, you know, so many of the good scientific studies have only been pouring out in the last 30 or 40 years. That's when the understanding of the disease has really jumped in a quantum way. There are apparently strong connections in the way the mind works between creativity and schizophrenia. The creative mind crosses boundaries. It creates analogies. Kevin used to see a coffee drainer, and he would say, "That looks like a bird's nest." Who else would make that kind of analogy? But his mind was always at work. He was a wonderful mimic. He was never cruel, but he could get someone in a stroke or two of a posture or a couple of words. So the creative impulse, which really sees no boundaries, and the schizophrenic impulse, which is aware of no boundaries, are the same. Kevin was a happy kid, one of the happiest. So, yes, that's an important thing to study, and it has led some people, some scientists such as R.D. Lang, the Scottish psychiatrist back in the 60s, to argue that psychosis is not a disease, it's a state of bliss. It's something that we all should aspire to. Well, that was flawed, but it came at a time when the counterculture was listening for this very message, and these kinds of false messages have really inhibited a sophisticated and compassionate study of schizophrenia.
You know, one of the things, too, you address is that Honoré, which is such a beautiful name, your wife,
is
you said she's it's not secretive. It's more like you just don't, there's certain things you don't talk about. How has the book affected her, and how's that been for you, too?
Well, Honoré is one of the strongest women in the world.
Well, she must be. I mean, she's for all you've endured.
She's gentle and loving. She has a PhD in biophysics and has taught biochemistry. She understands the human body. She's looking into cell growth in the uterus right now and writing papers about it. At the same time, Honoré has told me that when she was a young graduate student, she read an article about schizophrenia and put the paper down in horror. She could not conceive of such a thing ever happening. So we were both caught flat-footed, fairly well-informed people, conscientious parents. When Kevin started to give in to his symptoms, we really had no idea. We quickly sought care, but we were groping in the dark, and oddly enough, maybe we were in denial. When Dean, his older brother Dean's symptoms appeared, we thought maybe it was just the adolescent rite of passage, he's being gruff and alien. Well, no, that wasn't it. It was psychosis. And what we learned, one of the important things we learned, Lisa, is it's dangerous to trust an adolescent person to stay on a regimen of medications on their honor, on their promise. They don't want to believe they're sick. There's a syndrome called anosognosia. It's a Greek term meaning lack of insight, and it's like a parallel curse to schizophrenia. It tells the victim, you're fine. You don't have to be on meds. You're just fine. Kevin succumbed to that. He began hiding the pills. Dean, and I, every family, every parent who is listening to this, if you have the option of having your child treated via inoculation, do it if you can. But, you know, with all the necessary...
Of course.
Because it makes the victim accountable to a clinician. They have to show up once a month, and if they don't, then we know that something is amiss and they face hospitalization. So that carrot and stick approach has worked very well for Dean.
Oh, I'm so glad. That is huge. I know you mentioned that he's living with you and getting the love and the care, and that makes such a big difference.
Oh, yes, it does.
Kevin comes into your dreams. You know, my mother died of ovarian cancer when I was in my 20s, and for years I had these dreams where she would say, why did you tell everyone I died? I didn't die. There was this hopefulness. Now, I know you have dreams that he comes to. He's around 10 or 11, and he quits his guitar.
In the dream of Kevin, an Honore, oddly enough, told me that she has the same dream.
Wow.
Kevin is alive and with us and vital. He's usually about 13 or 14, but he stopped playing his guitar, and he won't pick it up again. And I think that is a metaphor for death. So he's with us, and yet he's not with us. And in life, that's what many parents experience. The child is with them, but not with them. And I think the dream was exploring that awful situation.
What advice do you have for parents who've lost their child to suicide? It's so important because it's just, I guess you got to just get through it, right? You can't go around it. You have to feel the pain.
I remember a line from a Carl Sandburg poem about the Civil War. I am the grass. Let me do my work. It is going to be ungodly painful. But over time, the fact that we are an adaptive species will carry us through. We'll never forget. We'll never stop loving. We'll never stop dreaming, many of us. But the fact is, adapt. Cling to that. Cling to the love of people near you and cherish the memories. That's all we can do.
Oh, that is so beautiful. Ron, you are always welcome here, and it's your help. The book is No One Cares About Crazy People, The Chaos and Heartbreak of Mental Health in America. Ron Powers, your New York Times bestselling author. Tell us all the ways we can find you and your fantastic book. You're also a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer as well.
That's healed over, Lisa. It's a long time ago.
It's healed over.
I went from being anonymous to overrated overnight.
Well, I think you're an absolute gem, let me tell you.
Thank you. And your listeners are very lucky because you are informed and you are engaged, and I think it would be great to hear you every day, honestly.
Oh, well, I'll give you all the ways to do it. Oh, Ron, you're so kind. Well, what about you? Do you have a website for the book?
Yes. I have a blog that update with news about the world of schizophrenia, and also photographs of Demon Kevin and clips of the music that they played together. So think of the title of the book, No One Cares About Crazy People, all lowercase, all one word, .com. No One Cares About Crazy People .com.
Oh, well, you are fantastic. Ron, thank you so much.